This is a special edition of Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the premier financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Now, for this special edition of Macro Voices, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Macro Voices All-Stars, episode 110th and final episode of Macro Voices All-Stars, was recorded on June 22nd, 2020. I'm Eric Townsend. As I mentioned, this will be our final episode of Macro Voices All-Stars, but we will continue to produce our flagship Thursday night Macro Voices podcast, so continue to stay tuned. We've got Harley Bassman coming up for a terrific interview this week. I want to take just this opportunity to send a personal thanks to Niels Kastrup Larsen, our sponsor at TopTradersUnplugged.com, which has made the Macro Voices All-Stars series possible. Niels put together a terrific list of all of the best investing books ever written. I highly encourage our listeners to take advantage of that. I'll tell you how you can claim your free copy at the end of this episode. Joining me for the final Macro Voices All-Stars is a good friend, Professor Anas Al-Haji, who is an energy markets expert. He's the former chief economist at NGP Energy Capital Markets, and he's also a former professor for the Colorado School of Mines. Anas, the reason I wanted to ask you to join us for our final Macro Voices All-Stars is I've been getting so many different views from so many different experts in the oil business about just what this COVID-19 crisis and its after effects, mostly the after effects, are really going to be. Because some people are saying, look, you shut in these wells, they'll never come back online again. Other people are saying that that's nonsense. It's trivial. All you have to do is a few taps on an iPad screen and you can turn the submersible pumps back on and these shale wells come right back and you can get back to full production without any problem. I know you tend to look at the bigger picture, not just shale wells and what does it take to get them back online, but how do we rebalance the entire market, including the floating storage that has been, all the oil that's been put into floating storage during this crisis, the politics of OPEC Plus, the technology dynamics of turning shale wells back on. How do you assimilate this whole picture? Give us the high-level overview of what all of this is going to mean to oil markets in coming years.
Thanks, Eric. I'm really pleased to be back on the show. When we talk about the current situation after COVID-19, we are talking about market equilibrium, what it takes to go back to equilibrium. The objective of Saudi Arabia, the objective of OPEC, is to go back to market equilibrium. So what is that market equilibrium? It seems that it means many things for many people. But in economics, market equilibrium means eliminating the surplus or eliminating any shortages. Right now, we have a massive surplus. So market equilibrium means eliminating that surplus. And OPEC intends to eliminate that surplus. So how much is that surplus? And can OPEC Plus do it? And the answer is, the surplus right now, we can measure it in several ways, but the best proxy for it is the size of the surplus in storage. And what we have right now in OECD, so I'm ignoring China for a moment here, we have about 180 million barrels in excess inventories. 180 million. That's a huge amount. And the question is, can Saudi Arabia, with its allies within OPEC Plus, eliminate that? When I say Saudi Arabia and its allies within OPEC Plus, I am assuming that some people are going to cheat. That I'm assuming that some countries are not going to abide by the quota. The best way to answer this question is to look at history. And the best way to look at is to see what they've done in 2017. In 2017, Saudi Arabia and its allies were able to reduce inventories by about 152 million barrels within 10 months. 120 million of that in the United States. By doing what? By cutting production and targeting a cut in exports to the United States. So they already done 152 in 2017 within 10 months. Here is what's different this time. There are many things that are different. Let's leave Corona on the side for a moment here. U.S. oil production increased by 1.2 million barrels a day during that period in 2017. Right now, it's going down by at least 1.8. So the difference is about 3 million between that time and now. That comes toward balance. If you look at Libya, as you know, Libya's oil production is about probably 30, 40,000 right now. Well, it was almost a million in 2017. Venezuela produced 1.9 million on average in 2017. It is producing about 600 now. So if you look at Libya, you look at the United States, you look at Venezuela, and now let's look at Iran. Iran production basically is half, or Iran exports is half what it was in 2017. Iraq production is way less than what is predicted to be in 2020. So we have some serious issues on the supply side that makes this time easier for OPEC to balance the or OPEC Plus to balance the market than 2017 by a large margin. Now, yes, we have increase in production relative to 2017 in places like Brazil and Norway, but these are really small amounts, and Guyana, these are small amounts relative to the decreases in other places. Then you take this picture and add the decline in investment and what the impact of that. One of the main lessons we learned from previous instances of lower oil prices in the past is that spending on maintenance decreases substantially. And as a result, every time we went through a period of low prices, we ended up with a following period of crises, accidents, fires, explosions throughout the world, even in the rich oil countries, not only in the poorer ones. So we are going to see it throughout the world. We are going to see those incidents. So you put all of those together, the answer is, yes, we can eliminate 180 million barrels of oil from the surplus, and we can do it probably within a year or less, assuming, of course, that the current circumstances will continue as is. And all of this, and we have not talked about demand yet. Demand, we are now finding out that those who talked about a decline in demand of 25 and 30 million in April and May, they were awfully wrong. We are finding out that the demand declined, but not that much. And instead of 20 and 25, the average in April probably is 7 to 8. So the demand basically is doing way, way better than expected. With the recovery, it's growing way better. So we are going to see improvement in the balances quickly, and we are going to see improvement in prices. The final point is regarding the recession and what kind of problems we are going to have with the recession. There is a total confusion here among some circles on the impact of the recession. If no lockdown with a recession is way better than a lockdown, what I see in some reports is that people are adding the impact of the recession to the lockdown, and that's a mistake. A recession with no lockdown is an increase in demand, at least because people are going out, people are working, people are traveling, people are going around regardless with the recession. So even with the recession, we are better off. But it seems there is an agreement among macroeconomists that this recession is going to be shorter than the recession of 2008-2009. And the recovery is going to be faster. So you add the demand, in this case, the higher demand, you add what I mentioned about supply, and you can see that the situation is way brighter for oil within in the next few months than what some people believe. In terms of shale, yes, we have those shutdowns. We have the shut-ins. We have companies that are bringing back wells, but the percentage of wells that are being brought back is only about 25% of what's been closed. And the reason is not the oil price of WTI or Louisiana Light or others. It's really the price differentials that we are seeing, for example, between the Bakken and the others. Once those price differentials basically improve, we are going to see a major comeback from those wells that have been shut in. At the end, I think by the end of the year, we are not going to have a single well, and talk about the major wells, I'm not talking about the others. All the major wells in shale will come back online, but we are going to end up with a major problem. The major problem is the following. Historically, as you know, we ended up with a situation where we have major spending in shale, major increase in drilling activities, major increase in completions to compensate for the high decline rates in shale and more. And because of that more, we were able to increase production month after month and year after year. Now we have the reversal. We have a major decline in investment. We have a major decline in rig count that already surpassed the threshold that is needed to maintain production. And as you know, in terms of fracking crews and in terms of completions, we are near zero. So what's going to happen is, because of this mismatch between the investment and the decline rates, we are going to see a major decline in shale production as a result of that, not because of the shut-ins. And that might last for about 2 years. How much is that? I think we will bottom around 9.8 to 10 million. That's for U.S. oil production. And then we are going to see a recovery. I strongly believe that we are going to have multiple peaks in shale. So this is not the end of shale. In fact, the shale probably is better off being kind of slimmed down a little bit. It's better for its health in the future and better for the companies and the investors.
Okay, Anas, so it sounds like your view could be summarized to say that the massive imbalance in the storage situation in the oil market that was created by this COVID-19 crisis will take about a year to burn off, but it can be burnt off and will be burnt off and will be resolved. That brings us to another question, though, which is, as we look from there, once we get past this, the long-term outlook for the oil market, you've had a different view than some other analysts. So tell us what's missing from the mainstream view about the long-term outlook for oil markets and how you see it differently.
Generally speaking, there are too many issues, and I know we have a limited time, so I'm going to focus only on one issue. What people are missing is we have all this. Historically, in the last couple of years in particular, we have all this talk about energy dominance and energy independence and the hype of shale. On the other side, we have all the hype of the impact of the increase in or the penetration of electric vehicles on oil demand. Please note here, I am not talking about the number of vehicles. I'm talking about the hype of the impact on oil demand. I think even those who are in the electric vehicle sector, they don't understand the points regarding the oil demand. But here is the point that I would like to mention today. People are forgetting that this information that everyone is talking about is public, which means that producers all over the world are reading it and hearing it. And they go to conferences and they listen to those people and they get those reports. So to assume that they will do nothing is naive. So the question is, what will those producers do to counter the major or the expected decline in demand? Even the International Energy Agency is missing this point. If they keep hammering this point, I don't want the oil, I don't want the oil, I'm going to go for electric vehicles, I'm going to go for renewables. If they keep hammering this message, everyone else is hearing it. And therefore, we are going to end up with one of two situations. One of them is a major decline in investment in upstream. And if those guys do not deliver on what they said they will deliver in terms of electric vehicles and renewable energy, then we are going to end up with energy crisis. Or they will do what Saudi Arabia is doing right now. They say, okay, you don't want my oil, that's fine. I'm going to convert that oil to materials. I'm not talking about oily petrochemicals and plastic. I'm talking about materials in general. So they can say, look, go ahead and convert all your cars to electric vehicles. I want to make sure that every part of that car is made from oil and that oil is coming from me. Go ahead and build your wind turbine. And I will make sure that all the materials that are needed for that wind turbine is made from oil. Go ahead and make your house more energy efficient. I will make sure that the materials used to build the house is coming from oil. And that's what's been missing all along from those discussions and the outlooks, that there are ways where those oil producers using technology, the same technology that's been used on the demand side, to use that oil to produce something so the demand for oil will continue. Here is the problem. We need the materials they are talking about. So they are going to export oil embedded in something else. And the problem is, what if our leaders and all those who are leading the discussion on shale or electric vehicles or renewables do not deliver the amount of energy they promised to deliver? Then we are going to end up with a massive energy crisis, because the Saudis and others are not going to export the crude oil unless we pay them a very high price that compensates for the profit they make from converting oil to materials. And I think that's the main point.
Okay, so to summarize, the scenario we should perhaps be most concerned about is the whole world essentially buys the story that, look, oil demand is going down, it's the way of the future, electric vehicles, renewables, et cetera, we're not going to need as much oil. That results in less investment in oil. Then the risk scenario is, it turns out that converting the entire world to electric vehicles when almost no major country in the OECD has the electric grid capacity to recharge all of those electric vehicles, and it would require a huge infrastructure build out, which most people haven't thought about. Then you get to the point where, oh, we need more oil than the investors bargained on. And the result is we have an under capacity to deliver, and that results in higher oil prices. First of all, do I have that overview correct? But more importantly, what's the time frame when that might happen? Are we talking a couple of years out, 10 years out?
You are correct on one part. The other part is converting that oil to materials.
Okay, but if that risk proves out, that it turns out we didn't have as much oil as we needed, and it results in an energy crisis where there's not enough oil to meet demand, and there's not enough capacity to produce more oil because of underinvestment, what's the time frame that that risk exists? Is it 2 years from now, 5 years from now, 10 years from now?
No, we are talking about 10 to 15 for this one.
Okay.
But we have another energy crisis coming up shorter than that. That's within the two to three years from now, simply because of all the shale issues on one side and the decline in investment on the other. So, yes, we will see higher prices. But here there is one more point to mention that is very important. People are talking about $100 oil, and we already have seen a report talking about $190. But then we heard again that it's less likely to go to 190. So I don't know why they mentioned 190 if it's less likely to get that. But people should pay attention to the following fact. In the United States, we have rules and regulations that govern the use of the strategic petroleum reserves. Other countries who are building strategic petroleum reserves do not have similar rules and regulations. What that means is, in the United States, the president or the Congress or the government is prohibited from using oil from the SPR to manipulate oil prices. But other countries can. And therefore, even the idea of reaching $100 becomes very difficult under this scenario. So the large increase in prices goes in two stages. The first stage is to 80, when other countries are going to use their strategic petroleum reserves to sell their reserves and make money because they already bought those at $10 and $20 and $30, and to prevent the increase from prices. And then the second stage basically after that is to go to 100 or more. But it's very hard to see oil prices going above the 80, of course, plus minus 5 here, because of other countries using their strategic petroleum reserves to manipulate prices.
Hannes, I can't thank you enough for a terrific final episode of Macro Voices All-Stars. Before I let you go, please tell our listeners who are interested in following your work how they can do so.
Of course, I am on Twitter. That's my multitasking chores most of the time. I always post things on Twitter while I am working. My Twitter handle is at Anas Alhaji, which is my first name, last name. I have some other materials on my website, anasalhaji.com. I am also an advisor to a website. It's in Arabic, but it had the capability of transferring to English immediately. It's called Attaqa, which is energy, ATTAQA.net, ATTAQA.net, which means energy. And there are a lot of materials there, too.
Hannes, I can't thank you enough for a great interview, and we do look forward to having you back on the Macro Voices flagship podcast. Again, listeners, this will be the final episode for Macro Voices All-Stars, our short-form format, but we'll still continue producing our flagship Thursday night podcast, and we do look forward to having Hannes back as a guest on that program. This episode of Macro Voices All-Stars was made possible by TopTradersUnplugged.com, the leading podcast on quant and rules-based investing. Be sure to claim your free copy of their recently updated guide to the best investing books ever written at TopTradersUnplugged.com/macro guide. And if you haven't heard it yet, be sure to check out my full-length interview with Niels Kastrup Larsen on trend following strategies, which is linked in your research roundup email. For the Macro Voices Podcast Network, I'm Eric Townsend.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Please register your free account at macrovoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly research roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts, Eric Townsend, shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices.